Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 50th birthday of a car that's carved out a big place for itself in American automotive history, the Ford Mustang. Jay Follis is an automotive historian. He's director of marketing at the Gilmore Car Museum in West Michigan, and his look at the history of Mustang is in the current issue of Michigan History Magazine. Welcome, Jay.
It's great to be here, Cindy.
And auto analyst John McElroy is here. John is host of the Autoline Daily webcast at autoline.tv. Hello, John McElroy.
Hello, Cindy.
Good to have you both here to talk Mustang. Jay, Ford introduced that Mustang in technically 1964 and a half, but take us back, if you will, to before that introduction. What hole in the market was Ford trying to fill?
Well, actually, they're trying to fill several. You have to really go back and look at it and realize they had just got kind of burned with the Edsel. And so Ford really didn't want to take a big leap into anything new. But you had all these young, creative, very persistent engineers, designers, guys from the marketing department that said, you know what, we have a dream car in mind and we want to do something with this. And they're very persistent. And in fact, they started holding kind of dream sessions off-site at the Fairfield Hotel, so they became known as the Fairfield Committee. The whole idea was they felt with the Edsel that they kind of had missed the mark. It wasn't their product, but they kind of felt that Ford missed the mark, but there was young guys, young adults, young families, young women that would be starting to buy a second car, not necessarily their first car, but their second car. And they did a lot of market research and came back to the executives and said, we've got to look at this a little differently. Let us take a stab at it. And so they were trying to fill several different markets with one car, which is kind of surprising.
But wasn't Ford doing well with a Thunderbird in the kind of fun sports car category?
They definitely were. And what the guys in the Fairfield Committee kind of felt was that they could do even better. And they kind of felt that if they were given just a little bit of leeway, they could do even better with what they had. They wanted to do something that was, it would be a sports car, but something that would really be geared towards a young audience that they knew there's a lot of young people to be getting their license in, in the next few years. There's a lot of people that now were in a position could buy a second car. And that was an area that Ford really never looked at, as people that would buy a second car and a second car for fun. And so that's where they really started, trying to kind of put on the pressure.
And John McElroy, we always hear the name of Lee Iacocca very, very much entwined with the Mustang. What did Iacocca and Mustang mean to each other?
Well, there's a whole bunch of fathers for the Mustang, because whenever there's a success in the automotive industry, a lot of people claim that they were part of it. And there's no question that Iacocca played a critical role. But I think it's fair to say that the most important role he played was approving the program and making sure that it got fully funded, because it's really an idea that was brought to him. But Iacocca was a young hard charger in the Ford Motor Company. In fact, I believe, if I remember right, he became president of the Ford division at 32 years of age, the youngest that anybody had ever achieved that position with. And, he wanted the cars to reflect this young, exuberant, can-do America that existed in the 1960s.
But he had to go to Henry Ford II, who was still kind of feeling that huge loss, Jay, that you talked about with the Edsel. Did he have to do quite a sales job on the deuce?
Oh, I believe so. In fact, not just with him, but the whole executive committee. Lee Iacocca kind of looked at those guys as being all these old bean counters, guys that didn't look at cars as anything more than just basic transportation. They didn't want gimmicks or anything like that. And I think that you're right, there's so many people that can take credit for any success, but there's a lot of people involved. And I think what Lee Iacocca really did was push the idea, kind of was the guy that was behind the committee to say, I'll take it and I'll kind of help push this through. And so, he had to do a lot of convincing. And I know the first meeting that he had where he sat down, Henry Ford II actually got up in the middle of the meeting and walked out. And, of course, Lee Iacocca looks at him and thinks, oh, no, we're crushed. What did I do? What did I say? Was he mad? Was he upset about something? And they realized they still had a lot of work ahead of them. The Ford name was on the building, so you had to get him on board before you could get the executive committee to do anything.
I did see a quote somewhere where Iacocca said that Henry Ford II told me if it wasn't a success, it would be my butt, and I'm paraphrasing, and I might be looking for a new job elsewhere. But it paid off, didn't it, John?
It did. In fact, one of the ways that they got Henry Ford II on board was asking him for his input. What should they do with the car? And I know this story from Hal Sperlich, the product planner at Ford at the time. who said that Henry Ford II decided that there really wasn't enough rear seat legroom. And they actually lengthened the car to accommodate that and to incorporate Henry Ford II's ideas. And so the original Mustang was actually going to be a few inches shorter than it turned out to be. And that's how they got Hank the Deuce, as he was nicknamed, on board with the program.
And would we say, is it fair to say, Jay, that this was a watershed moment in American auto history when this Mustang hit the streets?
Well, it definitely caused an epidemic. And part of that was just not just their ambitious goal of getting the car completed and approved and unveiled, but it was partly because they unveiled it at the World's Fair. It was completely something new. You know, usually your cars are introduced in the fall. This was going to be introduced in April, and it was at the World's Fair where they already knew there'd be a lot of people and a lot of buzz. And I think that buzz and all the marketing they did around it really helped create it. And then, of course, it was a good product. It wasn't just a buzz that people looked at and go, oh, wow, that was a failure. It really took off, and I think it became iconic because of that.
So it was a success both in terms of buzz and also dollars and cents, which, of course, kept it alive, correct?
Exactly. And as far as buzz, I don't think there's anything that's compared with it. You know, you can go back in history, and when Henry Ford came out with the Model A, they sold 400,000 sight unseen because of the Model T, you know, before that. This is probably the next thing, probably even bigger than that, because they were seen all over the place. They had major TV network shows the night before it was unveiled. They unveiled it to the press about 4 days beforehand, and they did little things that, you know, back then, that was a time where they're very secretive about new projects coming out. In fact, a lot of times at dealers, they would have paper covering the windows and say, see the brand new Cadillac or whatever they're introducing, see the brand new car, September whatever, and then they would pull the paper away, or they were very secretive. Well, what they did is some things that were probably intentional, like driving a car and parking it down in Detroit so photos could be taken of it, telling all the press 4 days before the unveiling, okay, you've signed out these PR kits, but it's all confidential. Well, who's going to keep that confidential? So they knew darn well they were going to go out and share what they'd seen, and that just helped build this whole hype that was built around the car. Like I said, they had the TV shows advertising it the night before. You could go down the road, you see a billboard saying the new Mustang's coming. Go to an airport and go, hey, look, there's a new Mustang in the airport. So you couldn't miss it.
I do remember the buzz. A friend of mine, classmate of mine, I was in grade school at the time. Her father worked for the Ethel Corporation and had a test one. And I remember when she rolled up to my house with her dad in this great car, and there truly was buzz, especially that first generation hit the road. John, how many times did Ford change the Mustang over the next five decades?
Well, you know, when it first came out, this was back in the days when Detroit still did the annual styling change. And we saw variations on the styling 1 year right after the other. Probably one of the biggest changes came at the height of the oil crisis in the 1970s, when they essentially moved the Mustang to the same platform as the Ford Pinto and renamed it the Mustang II. And amongst most hardcore Mustang enthusiasts, they don't like that version of the car very well. Ford later built a version of it, if you remember the old Ford Fairmont, which was built on what they called the Fox platform. And really, up until the very latest car that is just about to come out right now, it's been built on that same old platform. This is the first time for 2015 that we've seen a clean sheet design to the Mustang since about 1979, and that's what makes this new one so exciting.
If you've just joined us, we're marking the 50th birthday of the Ford Mustang and looking ahead at the 2015 Mustang coming very, very soon as we speak with auto analyst John McElroy and auto historian Jay Follis, who is, by the way, with the Gilmore Car Museum in West Michigan. Hey, Jay, was there ever a time when Mustang was close to extinction?
You know, I don't know if I would ever say there was a time it was close to extinction. John really hit it well when he said Mustang, too, not real well liked by the hardcore Mustang enthusiast. And I think that's just, that really says a lot. But I don't think it's ever close to extinction. Now, the idea, you know, before they ever got it on the drawing board, I think there's a couple times they really had to push and go back to the drawing board and say, okay, what are we going to do to make this happen? And I think a lot of it was just by the time they finally got the executive committee behind them and they could actually feel something was happening, then I think Mustang was there to stay.
Now, the average age of the Mustang drivers is late 40s, and we're hearing that Ford wants to bring younger drivers into the Mustang corner. How do they want to do that? I'll let you start with that, John.
Well, you know, one way to bring younger people back in is come out with a clean sheet car with exciting styling and all the technology that a younger generation wants today, especially when it comes to infotainment. So this thing has all the Bluetooth connectivity, all the touch screens, and all the other things that so many younger people want to see in the car today. It's also offered with a four-cylinder turbocharged engine, which we haven't seen in a while in this car. So it's not only going to deliver really terrific performance, it's going to get better fuel economy than you would have ever expected in a car like this.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned these things for the younger drivers, the connectivity and all that kind of thing. And didn't Ford stumble with the MyFord Touch?
Well, they did. No, you're exactly right. And that's an issue that they're still struggling with. You know, Ford first came out with Sync. And everybody loved it. And then they may have tried to push the technological envelope a little too fast for people's tastes, and there has been a backlash on that. Now, they've done software upgrades and the like, and they've improved it, but it still may not be where everybody would like to see it.
So we'll have to watch that. Jay Follis, this is the first time Ford's offering Mustang in Europe and Asia. What do you think the challenge will be to sell this car to European and Asian drivers who probably don't have the same appreciation for its history that we do here?
Actually, I don't know if it's going to be a big challenge for them, because we see in the museum world, we see a tremendous amount of interest in cars that are American built when you're overseas. There's just that American muscle, that, you know, the pony car, they seem to be very, very fascinated with it. So I think that we may be surprised, and it may do extremely well in those markets, because the classic cars that we see now are doing very, very well over there. And so if they are expecting to see Mustang and see something brand new, I think they're going to be very surprised. And I think it'll be a very pleasant surprise.
Any thoughts, John McElroy?
I think Jay has got it exactly right. The Mustang is known the world over and has been since it first came out. In fact, when Ford announced to its European dealers that it was going to bring the Mustang over to Europe, including versions with the steering wheel on the right-hand side to be able to be sold in England, for example, you could not believe the reaction of the dealers. They gave it a standing ovation. And in fact, to do the introduction, all Ford did was start up the engine offstage, and the dealers went nuts about it. So this is going to be very interesting to see how it sells overseas. I don't necessarily think it's going to sell in big numbers, but as a halo car, that is something that really puts the shine on the Ford brand. Ford could not have done anything better than offer the Mustang worldwide.
Well, here we are talking about Mustang 50 years after it was introduced. I'd like to wrap with the thoughts of both of you. Why do you think Mustang has endured, Jay?
Well, I think it came out at the right time, and they, for the most part, have stayed with those original themes, original styling, and the original idea behind it. I think what happens is when a car sways too far, you know, it may have come out as a great little sports car or whatever, and they sway too far. With the Mustang II, I think they really saw it on the wall. They got their message clear that we got to go back to what it was. And I think when cars have done that, they've stayed very loyal to that. They've got a loyal audience. And I think that's why it's iconic today, because it has stayed so true to that for the most part.
John McElroy?
Cindy, I think it's all about the way the car looks and what it represents. You don't look at that car and go, hey, what's that? You look at that car and you say, that's the Mustang. And just the name Mustang, you know, it's a wild horse. And people like to have their cars, or at least the people who are buying Mustangs, reflect what their personality is. Young, vivacious, outdoorsy, you know, wanting to get out and go and do things. And I think that's why this car has lasted so long. People just resonate with what it stands for.
Auto analyst John McElroy hosts the AutoLine daily webcast at autoline.tv. And Jay Follis is an automotive historian who's with the Gilmore Car Museum in West Michigan. You can find his look at the history of the Mustang in the current issue of Michigan History Magazine. You both make me want to go find a Mustang right now and hit the highway and enjoy Michigan fall driving with that Mustang. Great look back, and thanks very much to both of you for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.